Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 35, Ukraine Then and Now. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa. I'm Scott Burry in the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabe Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa. This is Season 2, Episode 35 of the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by two of the most impressive podcasters I've ever discovered. They're Romeo Kokryatsky and Anthony Bartaway, journalists and podcasters who do, together, the Ukraine Without Hype podcast. Yes, they're right there on the ground in Ukraine as drones and missiles attack all around them, night after night. I got in touch with them to ask about the history of the Second World War in the East and where it fits into current Ukrainian thought and culture, and also about parallels and differences between that conflict 80 years ago and the one that's happening right now. On the day of recording this episode, Sunday, 14 September 2023, Kyiv had gone through yet another night of heavy attack by Russian drones and missiles. Maybe that contributed to some of the connectivity issues we experienced, but Romeo and Anthony gallantly and generously persevered through it all. So, without further ado, let's get to the interview. Welcome, Romeo and Anthony. Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Great. So first, I think I'm going to ask you to describe your podcast and tell the listeners a little bit about yourselves. How did you come to develop this podcast?
I guess I'll take this one. I used to work at Hromadsky, which is a pretty well-known independent Ukrainian news outlet. And at some point, in their English language division, obviously, and at some point I needed to, we wanted to like put out a podcast and get the brand out there. So I was with my colleague Maria Romanenko at the time, and we came up with the idea, well, we need a podcast, and we were kind of struggling over a name. And one of my big pet peeves when it comes to Ukrainian coverage, especially prior to the full-scale invasion, was that there was very few kind of quote-unquote objective or at least unemotional reporting about Ukraine. It was either doomsaying of one sort of the other, Ukraine is so corrupt it's going to collapse any day, or the Russians are going to invade any day. I mean, they did eventually invade, but that was a bit doomery to say that in like 2015. And on top of that, I used to work for UATV, which was, I think it still exists, a government-sponsored English language news channel about Ukraine. And we were obviously expected to present the news in a very congratulatory fashion, let's say. So I figured, you know, if I was going to put out my own podcast, I wanted to provide news about Ukraine without blowing it up, without leaning into one extreme or the other, just how things are as I see them, with hopefully as much objectivity I can muster. And yeah, thus, and we got Ukraine Without Hype.
Yeah, and I obviously came in after the branding had already taken place, but the way I really saw the naming, to me, I kind of think back at the reporting around Russiagate/Ukrainegate, those scandals in the U.S., where a lot of that was actually based on these kind of off-caste, disgraced officials and political figures in Ukraine who had really been like out of the field for like years at that point, but saw the opportunity to come in and, you know, like in medieval times where some disgraced courtier would go to another country and kind of spin their tall tales to the new king to say, oh, if you listen to what I say, I'll be your, you know, puppet count in this neighboring county.
Yeah.
Like these people just spinning just these radical tales that made no sense. And everyone over here, like, thinking to themselves, why would you ever listen to what this person has to say about anything ever? Like, just complete nonsense. And so this whole image of Ukraine that had developed between these two scandals in the U.S. was one very kind of bizarre and bombastic and had no relationship with reality. So that was my goal, to counter that kind of thing with, here's Ukraine, a normal country with normal politics, with normal news, and things right. happen there normally. Yeah,
normal problems, normal concerns, normal victories, like not anything, not a martyr, not a hero, not a devil, just a normal place where normal people live.
Yeah, your description of bombastic and out of touch with reality sounds like the previous American administration, but maybe as a non-American, I shouldn't be saying things like that. Oh, well, it's recorded now. But so I guess, yeah, that was my sort of next question, was that there was a lot of either hype or misunderstanding or misappreciation of Ukraine in the U.S., in Canada, the West generally. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Like, honestly, I can give you an example from my own life. Sure. I grew up in the U.S. I was born in Ukraine, but I grew up in the U.S. And I moved back in 2014 in large part because the way the U.S. news media was reporting on the annexation of Crimea specifically was making me very much worry that we're going to have Russian tanks rolling down the streets of Kyiv. And my grandmother lives here. I didn't want to leave her alone. And that kind of hype, to use for lack of a better word, was really worrying to me. And when I got here, I immediately understood that the risk at that time of full-scale invasion was basically nil. The way the news media was reporting on the situation in Ukraine was, like Anthony said, very bombastic. Mm-hmm. And pretty much divorced from anything happening on the ground. So right. there's definitely a real habit, I would say, that Western news media has of over-exaggerating how things are.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that's another sort of commonality with my podcast, some of my books, is that there is very little understanding of the Eastern Front of World War II in the West. What we get here is basically the message that America, with the help of Britain, won the war, when really it was the Soviet Union that did the bulk of the fighting in dying in the East, in the European theater, at any rate. Yeah, and so I'm going to try to draw that link again another way between your podcast, which is about Ukraine today, and mine about the Eastern Front of 80 years ago. So one thing that's sitting here in Canada, comfortable Canada, is that we do get presented, you know, we're supposed to look at all sides of a story. And the story we get from the Russian side of this is that you know, Ukraine is a Nazi state. Russia is therefore threatened in much the same way it was in 1941. It's surrounded by enemies who are getting closer. And this special military operation is a defensive move. That seems, from what I'm hearing, Andy Raitt, is that seems to get a lot of resonance. That seems to be accepted by a large swathe of the population within Russia. Does it have any resonance either way in Ukraine? Are there people who think, yeah, this, you know, Russia has something to say in this situation, or has that really just out and out rejected? Is there any perception in Ukraine that, yeah, Russia does have some legitimate complaints?
This might have been the case, I think, prior to 2014. This possibly would have been even a relatively popular position, though after 2014, things, public opinion Ukraine regarding Russia started changing, I think, for obvious reasons. Nowadays, no, there is no sense. And a big part of that as well is the fact that, unlike Russia, Ukrainians have not been subject to like a concerted government effort of war mania, basically. One of the few, Vladimir Putin's regime is not really built on a sound ideological basis. They can't claim communism. They can't really claim capitalism. It's the ideological basis for his rule is just mafia stuff.
Yeah.
Like might makes right. And that's obviously not in the 21st century, not really that good of a unifying force. Mm-hmm. So in order to find some ideological basis to kind of unite the Russian populace about, Putin started in the early 2000s really pushing this idea of we're the country that won World War II. We're the country that defeated the fascists. We made the world safe, blah, blah, blah. And really, the populace there has been subject to this concerted propaganda effort for a decade, like, plus at this point.
Yeah.
And every single, like, that is their guiding ideology, pretty much. They don't have, they can't say, oh, we're democratic, oh, we're developed. It's literally just imperial nostalgia, and we won the Second World War. Ukraine never had anything like this. We didn't have any concerted push to glorify it. Of course, like every other post-Soviet nation, there is a monument to soldiers in every podunk little village in every single part of the country. And people do have, like, people are proud of the fact that, you know, our grandfathers fought the Nazis and we defended our land and so on. But this kind of obsession with the Second World War, that we are, our identity is so tied to this that it is impossible to extricate, that kind of thing doesn't really exist. And again, that wasn't an organic thing that developed in Russia. Right. It was specifically due to this decade plus of propaganda that the Putin regime has pushed.
Right, right. Well, that leads into this question, which kind of touches on my own heart, I suppose. But is the Second World War itself, the history there, is that still a sort of a prominent theme in Ukraine, either in its education, its histories, its popular culture, movies, books, and so on?
I mean, it's definitely being more de-emphasized now than it was previously, but there are still extant veterans movements that are relatively influential. Political leaders will still go and lay wreaths and flowers at the monuments of soldiers and so on.
Yeah.
All the eternal flames that the Soviets installed in every city are still burning. Like the local government takes care of it. So it's not, again, it's not an obsession, but it's not going anywhere. I mean, again, it was absolutely ruinous to Ukraine in particular. Mm-hmm. And that kind of memory is not going to just disappear just because Russia has invaded us. But due to the complex historical nuances in this whole conversation, it's not something that people are shoving in their faces or complaining too much. I mean, you still have people that will complain when a street is renamed from some old Soviet general to some Ukrainian folk hero.
Right.
You'll have a couple of people stand up and say, hey, blah, blah, blah. But they're typically considered politically irrelevant. So it's not really a thing. People, of course, are not going to like deny that there was World War II, or that we were somehow the bad guys, or that their grandparents were somehow bad guys for fighting in the Red Army or something.
Right.
But there is a much stronger emphasis on pretending, I guess, that Ukraine was defending its own land. And kind of de-emphasizing the role of the Soviet Union, the fact that, well, most Ukrainians were in the Red Army. We just kind of sweep that part aside and just focus on the defending our land against Nazis.
The history of the Second World War, as I try to say in my podcast. It was a very complicated one, especially for the other countries, Ukraine, Poland, the Baltic states, and so on. And so you get almost a four-sided war in Ukraine. In the Second World War, that four-sided war, there was a conflict also between Ukrainians who were looking for a national state independent of the USSR, who came into conflict with Polish resistance. And also then, of course, they were in conflict with the Germans. And now the situation is, of course, it's 8 decades later. A lot of things have changed. But there was that conflict. Now Poland and Germany are among Ukraine's most prominent allies. So is there in Ukraine any tension over that history?
So I'd say that if you really dig deep into things, you might find some people who have some lingering antipathies towards Poland or Germany, perhaps. But it's really all kind of academic, or, you know, if you get someone drunk enough, they'll start talking about how the Poles oppressed our people for X number of hundred years. But in the form of actual politics, how people think, not really, no. Poland is recognized as Ukraine's best friend in the world, essentially, not in immaterial terms as much as the United States, for sure, but in terms of moral support of all the refugees that are there.
Right.
The bond between Poland and Ukraine is about as strong as you can get, up there with, you know, Lithuania is the other part of that as well.
And it's important not to understate that a lot of migrant workers work in Poland. Right. Prior to the full-scale invasion, prior to even 2014, and especially after 2014, when working in Russia was falling out of vogue, a lot of migrant workers went to Ukraine. So it's very Ukrainians have simply been more exposed to Polish society. They've worked there. They have friends or family that have worked there. They've traveled there. So those ties have been built in a very real personal sense for most Ukrainians.
Yeah. And I have to say,
You go to the bus station in Przemyśl, the city on the other side of the border, and everyone there is Ukrainian. You go to different parts of Poland, you'll find, you know, Ukrainian restaurants, Ukrainian communities. Just walking down the street of Wrocław on the far west side of Poland, and, you know, you'll see Ukrainian flags in the windows. And I'm talking about before the current invasion, because I haven't left the country since the invasion. But I'd go to Poland then, and Ukrainian is very ubiquitous in Poland. Yeah. Ukrainians.
When we weren't locked down from the pandemic, my wife and I used to try to go to Europe once a year on a vacation. And I think in almost every trip, Ireland, Portugal, Czech Republic, every other trip, we've met Ukrainians either working somewhere or on vacation themselves. So I'd like to say, too, that I consider myself an honorary Ukrainian for a couple of reasons. First of all, I was born in Winnipeg. And secondly, I married a Ukrainian girl, so Ukrainian-Canadian. So I do know a few words, too. So I can order a meal.
That's the important thing, yeah.
And beer.
There you go.
The big question I like to sort of draw it back to my podcast, if I could, is looking at parallels between the experience in the Second World War and the current conflict, with maybe different countries, you know, playing the different roles. Of course, in this conflict, it's Russia that's the invader. But some of the same problems or issues still seem to exist. So we talk about supply lines and those being interdicted. Do you see any parallels in terms of the strategies that don't work but don't get changed, the problems with supply, or anything else that you think are an echo?
So I'll give you the more serious answer and the one that is kind of funny if you think about it afterwards. So the more serious side of things is, on one hand, this is a pure conflict between two heavily industrialized, two advanced, organized militaries, which is something that especially the West has not seen much of in a very long time. Mm-hmm. Really since Korea, I'd say, was the last time a war of this variety has taken place. So in this case, where there are large infantry movements, there's artillery. I don't know if many Western soldiers, Western service personnel have been on the receiving end of an artillery strike in their parents' generation, even. Mm-hmm. It's not something that American had to deal with much in you know, the Vietnam War. Like, yeah, back, you have to go back to Korea for that kind of thing. So having to kind of go back to kind of revert to the norm of mass pure conflict has been a real learning experience for Western militaries. A lot of the advice that Ukraine has gotten from Western militaries has been from the perspective of militaries that have been fighting, you know, counterinsurgencies for the last several decades. So it's kind of shocked the system in that way. So yeah, so there is artillery, there's defense in depth, there's, you know, tank warfare, which is, again, not the last time we saw tank warfare on any kind of peer level. What, maybe like the Israelis versus the Egyptians? I can't think of too many other examples of it in recent times. So
that recent, so
yeah, and that's, you know, even that is, well, you know, long before I've been around.
Yeah.
So this, but even you have to look at how that has changed. So the same kind of general overview of how the war works. Yeah, you know, this trench warfare, deep fortifications, that kind of thing, but what they didn't have in World War II was drones, of course. Mm-hmm. You can buy a drone at Best Buy that is the same as what is now being used in the field, oftentimes better. A lot of the drones being used by the Ukrainian military and the Russian military as well are very cheap drones bought off of China, off of Alibaba and Chinese websites. All they have to do is fly and maybe carry a grenade or a camera, yeah, which doesn't require much.
Yeah.
So look for how that's changed artillery, for example. I've been with artillery units in the field, and what they do is they take their artillery piece to a certain location, fire off for maybe a couple of minutes, and then get out of there because you're going to be seen by the drones and you're going to be hit within, you know, 5-10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's called scoot and shoot. You have to shoot and run quickly.
Yeah. Whereas in the Second World War, it was massed artillery. That's how you punctured the enemy defensive lines. The Soviet Union had the Katyusha rockets and systems, and they would rank 10 or 12 of these launching trucks in a nice long row, neatly staggered and in a set position and fire away. But you can't do that now.
No, that would get lit up. That would get lit up right now.
Yeah, because you can respond very quickly.
Same thing with tanks. You can't have the mass tank blitzkrieg type things. The Americans wanted us to do that, and we just didn't have the material for it. It was just that simple. People talking about, you know, the counteroffensive going slowly. There's not enough tanks to do that kind of thing with the kind of fortifications they're going up against. Yeah. Just again, go back to drones. You take a drone, if someone has the tank hatch open, have a grenade in a plastic cup carried by a drone, drop that in. We've seen it happen.
Yeah.
You take out a multi-million dollar tank with $300 worth of equipment. Same thing with these large numbers of shoulder-mounted missiles, especially that the Russians learned this very quickly early on in the invasion, where they had these long stretched out columns of tanks and armored vehicles, and the Ukrainians just kind of went to the side and blew them up with quite a lot of ease.
Yeah.
So now you can take out these very expensive massed systems with much more inexpensive, much more individual kind of weaponry that you couldn't do as much of in the Second World War.
And also, what's your take on this then? The big story of the Second World War, of course, it was a highly mobile war. You know, these tank forces moved very far, very quickly. And we don't see that today. You know, yeah, there's the complaint, which I think is totally unrealistic and unjustified, that the Ukrainian counteroffensive is going too slowly. But it does seem that it's not a mobile war.
Well, it isn't until it is again. Right. So we saw, for example, in the Kharkiv counteroffensive, that front line was fixed in place for quite a long time. But yeah. Then once that breakthrough happened, the Russians collapsed within the span of a week or 2 weeks, and they were all driven out of that territory very quickly. It'll be hard to do in the south right now because the Russians did not have the kind of defenses they have now in the south as they did in Kharkiv. Basically, there's a lot of fancy stuff going on with deployments and sleight of hand stuff going on where Ukraine was able to get Russia to drain as many forces away from Kharkiv as possible with, you know, the Kherson. It was a very complex operation there. But once those lines were broken in Kharkiv, it was donezo very quickly.
Romeo, you mentioned also about the difference between the Red Army of, you know, the 1940s or even of the 1980s and the the Russian army today.
It's a very common, I don't know, misconception or willful misconception that especially pro-Russia or even quote-unquote neutral commentators will make. It's like, oh, the Russians have the experience or the institutional memory of the Red Army. There's this professor that I follow on Twitter that I think is pretty insightful a lot of the time, Kamil Kalayev. And he is very insistent that, no, the Russian army has very little institutionally in common with the Soviet army, especially after the quote-unquote reforms that the Russian military undertook in the 2010s, late 2000s, where they were kind of trying to pivot to a modern Western-style counterinsurgence force, coin force. Didn't really work because Russia is incredibly corrupt. But that was what they were going for. And a lot of the kind of the old generals, the old military guys that had that institutional memory, they're just not in the military anymore. They are retired or dead, or they were not from Russia. They were Ukrainian or Belarusian, or they moved to Israel. Lots of reasons, but there really is no continuity between the Red Army and the modern Russian army, which is why you get a lot of these kind of pop cultural misconceptions that the Russians seem to have bought into, the blocking companies and mass human wave attacks, because there's just not a lot of people that remember how things actually were.
Right.
And they really did try to pivot to being a quote-unquote modern Western army, which while it didn't work out, it further degraded that institutional memory, which would have provided that connection. They're completely two separate armies. There's really almost no connection beyond using the same technology and the same materiel. There's really no connection.
Right. And a lot of the materiel today, the tanks and other vehicles, are still that Soviet era, you know, the T-70 series and so on. They were designed 50 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And while
on both sides of the conflict,
Russia's case, they really did try to modernize. Mm-hmm. But what we saw is they modernized pretty much just the elite units. Everything new was for export. And the elite units got a couple of things, and their doctrine was kind of stuck between whatever they remembered of Soviet technique and trying to pivot to a modern force. And it doesn't seem to have paid off, whatever they attempted to do there.
Well, and this is something else that I saw as a parallel, is that there's a strategy, and it was on both sides in the Second World War. Here's our strategy. We're going to do this. Oh, it didn't work. Well, we're going to do it again, and we're going to keep doing it. And I kind of see that same thing happening on the Russian side now, is that, you know, we're going to use the mass human waves, and we're going to use the blocking troops or the blocking units, but it doesn't pay off. But I don't see any change. In fact, I don't see the Russians have done much of anything in the last several months in Ukraine.
I mean, I think that is also a bit overplayed and overstated, because when I speak to soldiers on the front, they do say that the Russians have adapted. They are making mass use of drones, just like the Ukrainians, for recon, for grenade deliveries. They've started using EMP and jamming weapons to counter drones. So they've even gotten very good at nailing down artillery positions using drone triangulation. So they really do, they have adapted, not evenly, not quickly, but I think it is a mistake to say that they're just trying the same thing. They're just not very good at what they're doing, but they are trying.
One thing that that we learned is at first there weren't really the human wave attacks. There was, you know, the Kyiv Blitzkrieg, of course, failed miserably, but that's just because they did not expect there to really be resistance. But if you look at the only Russian victory in the last, you know, year of the war, it's Bakhmut. And how was Bakhmut won? It was through these, you know, kind of suicide charges, where they would send out small teams and then of these convict soldiers, watch them get blown up, and then wherever they got blown up from, blow that up. Right. So mass use of these human waves, which was actually kind of, you know, the funny thing that I mentioned earlier, where in World War II, the Soviet army was not how it's seen in pop culture of, you know, just rush everyone forward and see what happens. It's not enemy at the gates. It was much more complex than that. But now we have seen some cases in the Russian side where they kind of had done that. And because they thought that was working in Bakhmut, they tried to do it elsewhere. In Vuhledar the main one of the there's the winter offensive of, you know, February, March of this year, where they tried to push on a lot of places, and Vuhledar was one of them. They tried these human wave attacks and just got torn apart for their trouble. And because they thought that that's what the Russian army does, partially because of this pop culture idea, and partially because of a misreading of Bakhmut.
So the hype or the mythology that has been developed has been almost realized in the current conflict.
Well, the other one would be like the blocking, as we were talking about, where, again, the pop culture idea, moving enemy of the gates, have that machine gun behind them, prevent them from retreating, never happened, at least as far as I'm aware of. But if you look at, again, Bakhmut, when Wagner forces were withdrawing from their positions that they were stationed with regular Russian army. They had just taken Bakhmut and were getting out. But on the way that they were doing that, they didn't tell their regular army comrades that they were leaving. And when the Ukrainian forces pushed up against where these Wagner lines used to be, they found them very lightly defended because there are much less soldiers there. And when the Russian soldiers tried to retreat, they were met with blocking units that prevented them from retreating. And
they had to use the Chechens to do something.
Yeah.
Kadyrov isn't going to put his countrymen on the front lines, but shooting fellow Russians, so the Chechens love that.
Yeah, there are other instances of especially Russian conscripts from ethnic minority regions like Buryatia, how they were prevented from retreating in some places. In the Kharkiv offensive, some people tried to retreat across the Russian border because the Ukrainian advance was so quick, and they weren't allowed to do that. So like this pop culture idea of what a blocking unit was that didn't actually exist in World War II, they were more glorified military policemen most of the time, was actually implemented on a small scale, at least, by the Russian army today.
Thank you, Romeo and Anthony. Before we go to my next question, let's take a short break. Remember, you can support this podcast in multiple ways. Make a monthly or a one-time donation through Patreon. That's patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Through reviews on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you follow this podcast on. And by telling your friends who are into history of the Eastern Front of World War II or history in general. Let them know. BeyondBarbarossa.ca.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to episode 35 of Beyond Barbarossa. I'm joined virtually in the Redbeard studio by Anthony Bartoway and Romeo Kokryatsky from the Ukraine Without Hype podcast. Now we move into Ukraine, and one of the features of the war in Ukraine in the Second World War that struck me was all those social and political divisions, East, West, Catholic, Orthodox, Jewish, left and right, as well as those interethnic conflicts in the western part of Ukraine between Ukrainians who were fighting for an independent national state and the Poles who were also fighting for an independent national state. But there was, let's just say, some disagreement over where that border should be. So those ethnic and religious and regional differences, have they changed? Have they gone away? And is Ukraine a more ethnically diverse or less? And at the same time, is it more or less cohesive today?
So cohesion and diversity, that's two separate questions, I think.
Yes.
So with diversity, ultimately, the great tragedy of the 20th century is that Ukraine is no longer as diverse as it once was. And the reasons for that, between the Holocaust, between Stalin's deportations, between Polish operation of the NKVD, it turned Ukraine from a much more religiously, ethnically diverse place to a more homogeneous one. So, I mean, compare Kyiv in 1920, when it was a like 25% Jewish city, to today when it's a 2%, 1% Jewish city. It's a very big difference. There's still, of course, the outlines of where that history was. You know, a lot of, you know, famous buildings were built by Jewish residents, for example, but it's not the same. And ultimately, that is a world that no longer exists and never will exist again. Cohesion, though. The cohesion issue is a very different topic. I am a Jew. I have reported on the Jewish community throughout this country, north, south, east, and west. I've done a lot of projects, spoken to a lot of community leaders and rabbis, my friends, and the difference now and even in the 90s of the acceptance of the Jewish community is like night and day. There are very public Jewish gatherings. And for example, I was once walking down the street with one of my friends and we saw an advertisement for a Hanukkah concert. Obviously, we can't have these things now due to the war. Mass meetings are rare and far and few between, so we haven't had that kind of thing. But before the current invasion, we saw this advertisement and they were flabbergasted, because when they grew up, this is a couple of years, like 2015, this story happened,
right?
Because as they were growing up, you know, in the early 90s, and still having that lingering Soviet idea of you have to hide who you are from the world, there's an intense anti-Semitism, discrimination. And from that to seeing, you know, an advertisement for a Hanukkah concert on this giant billboard, it was a massive difference between how things were and how things are. Mm. I've walked around in my kippah before, and I did not feel any hostility whatsoever. Of course, the president of Ukraine is a Jew, right. Not only a Jew, but a very prototypical example of a Jew of his generation of, you know, he's literally a comedian who owned a media empire. He fits a lot of stereotypes, and he was still beloved for him.
Right.
And is now, you know, a hero of the country.
Right. So if he were American, he'd be in Hollywood.
Yeah. If he was Hollywood and then became the war hero of the country. Yeah. That's if Dave kind Letterman. Kind
of a Reagan trajectory now that you think about it.
Kind of a Reagan-esque trajectory, but more, he wasn't really a comedian. If you think of like, you know, if Seinfeld became Eisenhower.
Yeah,
that's kind of the feel to it.
So he has to start by actually being an entertaining actor of some sort.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Reagan's movies. And not only that, like when the election for Zelensky was taking place, a lot of the people in the Jewish community were a bit afraid because, oh, a Jew is running for the president. There's going to be a lot of anti-Semitic attacks on him. Never happened. Never became an issue. Not even once.
Right.
I did not hear anything personally degrading Zelensky for being Jewish, even from his political opponents. You'd have to go to like the weird corners of the internet to find that kind of thing.
Well, okay, but this brings up that trope that anti-Semitism is a powerful thing in Ukraine today. Anthony, what's your response to that?
I mean, anti-Semitism exists everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say I never experienced any anti-Semitism whatsoever. But let's put it this way. In America, every synagogue now has very heavy security because there have been a wave of mass shootings at synagogues by people with these extreme far-right beliefs of you know, white replacement and all that kind of stuff. The Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, that was the largest anti-Semitic attack in American history. If a Jew goes to synagogue, they have to keep in mind that something may happen. That has never happened in independent Ukraine. Okay. There has never been a Tree of Life attack in independent Ukraine. I feel safer in Ukraine as a Jew than I would in the United States. There are rarely something like some graffiti or something on a synagogue. There's one incident like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where someone left a dead animal on the synagogue steps in some town far out west. But the fact that I had to think of that one specific example from that long ago, and it was just vandalism. Anti-Semitic violence does not occur in Ukraine on any level that even registers to people who monitor these kinds of things.
It's not a part of the political discourse.
It's not a part of political discourse. It's not a part of the social discourse. Mm.
People don't really even make jokes about it on TV.
Yeah, it's not a thing. For example, you'll hear Ukrainians in Odessa, which was formerly a very Jewish city and no longer is again because of the Holocaust and all that. But the idea of Jewishness is so ingrained into being an Odessaite that if you are an Odessaite, you're a little bit Jewish. It just kind of goes along with the package. Like you'll be walking down the street there and someone will be playing Hava Nagila on the accordion.
Yeah.
It's just part of the ambiance there. And really, even if you look at, you know, Kyiv, the city authorities have been working very closely with the Jewish community here. And it's really opened up to the rest of the country because people are interested in their roots. And maybe there might be, you know, some downsides to that. Historical memory is always a very touchy topic, no matter where you are in the world. I mean, talk about, go to an American and talk about Confederate statues or George Washington wasn't exactly very nice to the natives, and he's our pristine national leader.
Yeah.
Every country has these problems. I've had, you know, very heated arguments about these issues in Ukraine, but ultimately they're just that. They're theoretical. They're in the air. They're not lived experience in any way. And the other side of this awakening to identity is looking back at how things were. So there has been more interest in Ukraine's Jewish history as well, especially since the Maidan. So you hear about the Maidan, like, you know, the neo-Nazis overthrow the government.
Yeah,
the Maidan was the catalyst for a lot of the revival of the Jewish community in Ukraine, in that everything in Ukraine became much more focused towards civil society, towards, you know, building things up as a country, towards energizing people's identity of who they are, and not just an appendage of an empire, but who you are. And part of that was Jews kind of reigniting their identity here and being met very welcomingly by a broader society who is interested in that themselves.
And I want to note from a like state policy point of view that after the Maidan, the government made a big accent, a lot of emphasis on the repression of Crimean Tatars in Crimea. And as a result, the Ukrainian government was sort of forced to promote diversity, because they didn't push forward this issue internationally as, oh, this is just some ethnic minority. Yeah, they're getting oppressed, but, you know, Crimea is Ukrainian or whatever. They fully accepted Crimean Tatars being dark-skinned Muslims as fully Ukrainian, as authentically Ukrainian as any Orthodox Ukrainian with Enko at the end of their name. That was
a Ukrainian that, is a Ukrainian is a Ukrainian.
Yeah, exactly. There was really, after Maidan, a very strong push from the state level to define Ukrainian as a civil idea, not a nationalist one.
Mm-hmm.
That you are Ukrainian if you live here, if you believe in the values of democracy and free speech, blah blah blah. That is what defines you as Ukrainian, not having some specific ethnicity or what have you. And that has really also helped acceptance, because it's right. Just not socially acceptable to say something bad about Muslims, for example, because, well, Crimean Tatars are Muslims. They're being oppressed by Russians directly. Their communities have been utterly devastated. They're being dispossessed and deported. So what are you going to say? Those, they're not true Ukrainians? Of course not. They're just as Ukrainian as anyone else.
One of the things that happened after the war was the unification, Western and Eastern parts of the country. So Halyczyna, Volhynia, Polisia, which had been part of Poland and various other times, other countries, into Ukraine. Is there any persistent division, rivalry, distinction between far Western and Eastern part of Ukraine today?
Not, well, I'll say that there are, of course, regional divisions, just like there are in any country. From the North, what they think of the Southerners, someone from Texas, what they think of California, et cetera, et cetera. There's always regional differences.
Thinks of Albertans.
Yeah. So what the Quebecois think of anyone else. So there's always regional differences. And I will say they have been continuously eroded by Russian actions. After 2014, obviously the initial invasion was kind of a unifying event. Like, okay, you speak Russian, I speak Ukrainian, but we're all Ukrainians. We're all being attacked by Russia. Russia wants to kill all of us. They don't really care what language we speak. They want to make us all Russian and destroy our Ukrainian identity. And the kind of stereotypes that people had of each other, the regional stereotypes that people had of each other, started to erode. But after February 24th, they really started to erode, because at that point, it was no longer possible to be ambivalent about Russia. If after 2014, you still had a pro-Russian electorate in some parts, or at least people who were ambivalent or had strong historical ties, especially on the border regions. None of that mattered after February 24th. It was quite obvious that this was not a question one could be neutral on. You hated the Katsap, and it didn't matter what language you spoke. And even the kind of traditionally Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine, in Odessa, for example, which was always a very Russian-speaking city, people make an active effort to speak Ukrainian. In Kharkiv, people make an active effort to speak Ukrainian. These were all very staunchly Russian-speaking cities. Right. So Russians' own actions have pushed Ukrainians out of these regional differences and into this kind of unifying Ukrainian identity. We are at least in part defined by the fact that the Russians want to kill us all. And there is no one under any delusions that there is some like peace or some agreement, or if we just give Russia what they want, they'll just leave us alone. No one wants to live in Russia. No one wants to be Russian. And even if you speak Russian, it's not, it's in no way signifies that you want anything to do with Russia.
Right.
And I've been pretty much everywhere in Ukraine at this point. And ultimately, regional differences are almost more of geography than anything else. Like if you're in the south, there's going to be seafood. If you're in, you know, the Carpathians, there's going to be more people wearing wool. Like it's not, you know, these drastic cultural differences of east and west, never the twain shall meet. It's right. Just, you know, the logical conclusion of the kind of lifestyle that you're living in that particular climate zone more than anything else.
And I'd also like to note that a lot of the regional differences have always, like, the biggest regional differences have always been in Ukraine, not west or north or east or whatever. It has been urban versus rural.
Absolutely.
If you are a rural Ukrainian, you live kind of one way, which regardless of what part of Ukraine you're from, if you go to a village in any other part of the country, you will instantly recognize everything that's going on. And everyone's traditions will be basically the same. You'll have pretty much the same exact lifestyle. Nothing will really change. The bigger cultural difference has always been whether you live in a city or whether you live in the country.
Right. Like even with Donbass, there was still that urban-rural divide of if you lived in Donetsk City, Luhansk City, you're probably speaking Russian most of the time. But there was still large parts of the countryside that would speak Ukrainian.
Oh.
So even then, even on that level, it is more urban-rural than geographic. And like most of my friends even are, you know, quote unquote, Russian speakers from the Southeast, and they're not any less Ukrainian than anyone else. And beyond that, I'd say are often more passionate about these kinds of things than the so-called nationalist people out West, because those are the people who have been most directly affected by the war. These are the people who have, in 2014, had to become refugees the first time around. Now the larger part of the country, and you know, Zaporizhia Oblast, Kherson Oblast, the people who have had their lives most directly affected are the ones who are often the most angry for obvious reasons. Yeah. So not only would these people reject the idea that they're anything but Ukrainian, even though they grew up speaking Russian as their first language in a part of the country that I'm hearing foreigners say is naturally Russia or whatever, they would outright take offense to the idea that they would be anything other than Ukrainian.
That's sparked so many different ideas and questions, but those would be for different podcasts. So to bring it back to mine, if I could, my latest episode is about the resistance to German and Soviet occupation in Ukraine and Poland. So if there is any, what is the current perception within Ukrainian society today of the Ukrainian insurgent army during the war, UPA? What's the current feeling about that?
They're an aesthetic That's what they're an aesthetic more than anything else. Of the people who have some connection to that in a positive way, and many people do, many people don't, but many people do. Those who do, there's no real connection to whatever ideology they may have had. There's no real connection to whatever actions they may have had. It's just the general vibe that they fought for Ukrainian independence, and that's kind of the start and end of that sentence. Very few of them, I should say, are terribly familiar with, you know, the writings of Dmytro Donsov. Very few of them have any inkling that Ukraine should follow the ideology of those people. It's just they fought the Soviets, they fought the Nazis for independent Ukraine, and everything else is kind of academic. One friend actually refers to Bandera as a nationalist Santa Claus, because he is someone
I would never have put those two ideas together.
He's not someone who actually exists. After the war, after his assassination, there was an idea of Stepan Bandera that existed within the Soviet Union that had very little to do with the actual man himself. He was, you know, the great villain who was, you know, killing all the Russians and all that. In actuality, the man spent the entire war in prison.
Yeah.
He himself did basically nothing. His philosophy was odious, but he did not have the ability to do anything himself, basically. So there was this mythology built around him as... I should pause that for a second and say that, keep in mind, and this is a very big idea, so I'll slow me down at any point. The Soviet Union did not see the crimes of the Holocaust as the actual crime of Nazi Germany. The thing Nazi Germany did that was bad was invade the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can actually see that reflected in modern Russian propaganda.
You see it in, like, even the Holocaust memorial at Babi Yar. It did not say here Jews were killed. It said the Soviet citizens of Kiev were killed. Right. The entire...
They changed that now.
Yeah, it's changed now, but how it was.
But yeah, the Soviet Union didn't really, like, Soviets. The problem wasn't that they were exterminating all the Jews. It was that they were exterminating Soviets.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So what Bandera did was he fought against the Soviet Union, and everything else was irrelevant. And that's how it was taught in the Soviet Union. Okay. Well, fast forward to, you know, the 80s, 90s, now. That kind of Soviet of idea of Bandera, where his thing was he fought the Soviet Union, stayed around, except now it was a good thing. So,
okay.
Yeah. So what he did was fight the Soviet Union in 1970s. That was a bad thing. And today, that's a good thing.
Right.
And that's just what it is. Oun Upa is an abstraction. It is it is basically a construct that was created by Soviet propaganda. Like, I don't mean this literally. There is, of course, an actual Oun Upa that did, like, pretty terrible things in addition to fighting for Ukrainian independence. Mm-hmm. But because the
Soviet Union demonized it so much, it became like a rallying cry for Ukrainian independence.
Right.
Yeah, it became the things they did, not because Ukrainians support or even really care about the things they did, but specifically because it was so demonized by the Soviet Union that it must be good.
The thing that is either being celebrated or demonized, either way, is not the actual Oun Upa. It's the Soviet construct of what the Oun Upa was.
Right.
You're either for or against that Soviet construct. And that's really what's going on. And that's not something that I think either people strongly for or against them would like to admit to. They would like to think they're talking about, like, this actual historical debate, when frankly it's not. It's about this construct.
I'm going to go to my last question. What is the biggest misconception about Ukraine that the West has today? What do we need to understand?
I don't know. Maybe this is my own bias, but I get the sense sometimes talking to Westerners about Ukraine that Ukraine is seen as this kind of corrupt African or South American oligarch state, that everything in this country is just hugely, hugely corrupt and doesn't work, and our politicians are all venal little bastards who just steal money. And the thing is, that is also a commonly held opinion within Ukraine. But that is not an accurate picture of what Ukraine is. The fact that there is still mass corruption, like, that's a fact. The Supreme Justice of the Supreme Court is currently in jail for mass corruption, for grand corruption. But the fact is, he was charged and tried for this. Like, he doesn't have impunity anymore. That impunity is gone. Like, we have more or less independent anti-corruption bodies that function despite all of the corruption going around. And the reason we know all the corruption that is going around is because we have journalists that are actively uncovering these schemes. We have anti-corruption bodies that are investigating and then importantly prosecuting and convicting people on these schemes. So while, yes, Ukraine is corrupt, it is trying not to be. We are doing our best to actually hold accountability for all these corrupt actions, and this accountability did not exist prior to the Maidan. It just, even for years after the Maidan, especially for judges, especially for people in law enforcement, it just didn't exist, and now it does. And the head judge of the country's Supreme Court is going to jail because he was convicted of taking millions and millions of dollars in bribes.
Right.
This is massive progress, and I think it'd be great if more Westerners and Ukrainians both saw that and acknowledged that this is a thing that we are doing. We are changing.
The misconception that I would like to point out is the idea that Ukrainians can basically only do what foreigners tell them to do. And this comes out in so many ways. I would be here forever if I wanted to enumerate all of them. Maidan wasn't about, you know, the police just wailing on protesters and murdering 100 of them. It was because, you know, of a super secret CIA plot that apparently paid off thousands upon thousands of people throughout the country to do their bidding for them. Absurd. About how Ukrainians only want to resist their country being invaded because America forces them to, about how everything that happens here is because of some Western plot or because of some cabal of people that make people do things against their will, when Ukrainians have really been some of the most active people I've ever seen in my life. They care deeply about their country, about their people. They will not take guff from anybody, and they will fight for what they believe in and for their families and for their survival. And the idea that anyone would see that any other way is so outside of the realm of reality that it is absurd.
Well put. We have 2 minutes left, so can you guys give me 1 minute on your podcast and why my listeners, who are history buffs, should listen to Ukraine Without Hype?
Well, for one thing, and this is Romy Kratsky, the co-founder of the Ukraine Without Hype podcast, speaking, is that you get to listen to history in the making. There is, I think, no doubts in anyone's mind that the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine is a world historical moment. It is going to shape the geopolitical landscape in ways we cannot even imagine. And one of the best ways to keep up to date with all of the myriad changes and twists and turns of this incredibly important historical moment is by listening to Ukraine Without Hype, hosted by me, Romeo Kratsky, and my colleague, Anthony Bardaway.
And I'd also add that as a history wonk myself, I often throw in kind of not very well known periods of history just completely off the top of my head, because I try to think of things on the spot. We had one episode where I kind of described the current rise in Russian nationalism going back to weird ideological experiments after the Napoleonic War and how it developed from there. So I touch on those things as well. So if you're listening, you'll get some of that.
Gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay. Slava Ukraina.
Heroin Slava.
Those erudite gentlemen were Romeo Kokryatsky and Anthony Bartoway of Kyiv, Ukraine. Together, they produced the Ukraine Without Hype podcast, reporting regularly on Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine. Once again, I want to thank them for their generosity in sharing their thoughts and analysis with me and with you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning your podcaster to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. If you'd like to learn more about the Ukraine Without Hype podcast or any of our guests on the show, see the show notes in your podcasting app or visit this podcast's website, beyondbarbarossa.ca. I put all the links in there. You can also find more links so you can make comments, ask questions, or share your thoughts about this podcast, about the Second World War on the Eastern Front, the current war in Ukraine, or history podcasting. If you did like this episode, I'd really appreciate a rating or a review on your preferred podcasting app. I want to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon and other sources, and everyone who has listened to me today. Next episode, in 2 weeks, returns to the chronological narrative, continuing with the story of the Siege of Stalingrad, the bloodiest battle in history. I hope to talk to you then. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina!